Hi everyone. We were just having lunch and I decided to add in a bunch of plots, which might be quite random. So if I don't make sense at any time, blame it on me and just yell at me and just, you know, raise your hand and ask questions, right? And I have not given a talk to so many theorists before, so I'm a little bit scared, to be honest. So just ask questions, all right? I'm going to talk about Planck electrical structure and cosmological analysis and machine, and I'll be explaining what they are very soon. But for now, I will be showing my first attempt of Photoshop, my postdoc's picture, into this group picture. At CMU, we just, I don't know if you can see it clearly, but we just had a bunch of hires, a lot of postdocs and students. If you recognize upstairs, Rachel Mandelbaum, Pete Track were there, Tiziana, Rupert were there. Jeff Peterson wasn't there that day, but we will also add Matt Walker and Raphael Flower this coming year. So we're quite excited about the group working pretty young, actually, all of us. So come over and visit anytime. Well, I added people's picture on it directly without really trying very hard. I circled the two postdocs. I actually did most of the work I'm talking about today. And I'll be showing what they have done very quickly. So Planck news and why we care about BAO. So Planck intermediate data release, just to remind people, there are people who are saying that the Planck anomalies were probably going to go away just because it's an early data release, but that's incorrect. I've heard it multiple times, so I'm going to correct that. It's actually a full temperature data release, which we'll have more later, but that's the nominal data release is out. It's fully included. Lambda CDM survives another test. That's really cool. Well, I don't know. It's really cool for some of us. Planck results in significant tension with the H0 measurements, but also in excellent agreement with BAO measurements, right? So I'm trying to, you know, warm you guys up to the Baron-Kosick oscillation results that we had. This is a plot showing the H0 parameter measured by Planck versus all these other H0 measurements. And you can see the tension, it's quite strong depending on which error bar you take. Right, so if you use the Planck error bar, it could be pretty far away from Cepheus or the Hubble Key Project, depending, you know, which error bar you take. Just for some quick introduction, I know you guys probably heard a lot about this by then. COBE was like this, and WMAP was like that, and Planck was much better, and it's full sky, right? And then better resolution ones we have, of course, from the ground with Hubble Telescope and Common Cosmology Telescope, which are both included, like the results were included in the Planck analysis at the high L measurements. I think I did a Google search 2 days after or a few days after about Planck, and we have 173 different news sources about it, so that was kind of cool. And we were on New York Times, but what made my day was we were on Onion, which was absolutely the best time for me. And they asked the people, you know, what they think about Planck release. And they said, well, you know, the universe is older and wider than previously thought, so how do they feel about it? And I don't know if you can read it, but the first person was like, how embarrassing. The second person is like, well, typical, you gave birth to a few trillion galaxies, and people just talk about how fat and old you are. The third one, of course, quotes the Bible very well. I was pretty happy about that myself. Back a little bit more seriously, Lambda CDM makes a very precise prediction. I'm going to walk you through a little bit of different CMB outputs from WMAP9, which is, well, the thin line here is the WMAP9 Lambda CDM model back then already. And there is an error bar here, which you can barely see, even if you squint your eyes, it's 68 confidence level prediction of the Lambda CDM given the WMAP9 data. And that's just to show you, if you have different cosmology, what are the differences. And we added ACT and SCP data on it. And now we just go to add the Planck data. And you can see that they actually agree quite okay overall. I'm assuming a little of the differences that people probably all heard about. Like at low L, there is an offset between the Planck and WMAP starting around the first peak. And there's like a whole paper about this right now. And people are still discussing whether this is real, which there was a discussion at lunch. We were talking about 270 gigahertz for the people who were in the loop. So we might or might not still have that later on, but we'll see.
What's the current thinking?
Current thinking or rumor slash whatever. You should take a look at the Spergel's talk at the Davis conference.
Yeah, we're aware of that.
Exactly.
But that's, I think, not quite the same.
Not exactly the same, but then they were claiming basically a lot of differences come from how, you know, the 270 gigahertz was
right,
causing
so,
it.
Yeah, right. So last week, I think that was true. This week, apparently, he's like, you know, backed off on much of that.
There's a huge discussion going on. I don't know how to speculate it. I mean, I talked to the WMAP team people, and then plant people have their own discussions and processing all the maps again, and we don't know, I think, until later on. But it's one anomaly, so we shouldn't worry too much about it.
Yeah, so when you compare the, I mean, in here it looks like the theory predictions are very close. But so I thought that there was supposed to be an overall like 2 or 3% disagreement.
I can show you quickly very soon.
This, I mean, she's showing, right?
Oh, is that, can you already see that
error?
Yeah, you can see that already. I mean, the error bars are tiny.
Yeah, but right, I don't know.
It just is so precise, the measurements. I can show you quickly. Well, there is a paper that talked about, you know, the anomaly stuff, but then that's what I meant by that paper. There is a cool thing to look at if you want to check, you know, WMAP7 plus SVT versus Planck, then you see the significance of all these differences. And but people will argue that there's a different reason that caused this. We don't know yet. There is still a lot of discussions going on. But then what I was going to say is that, well, Boss kind of predicted this. Not exactly, but this is 2012. We published a paper on the baryonacoustic oscillation distance scale. And basically, this plot, which you might want to concentrate on, is to show you if you predict the distances using WMAP, I think, 7 back then, and what we had. Compare that result, that should be about 1, right? So if WMAP 7 was correct, all these points will lie on 1, basically. And we were a little bit far away, and we were a little worried, actually. And if you show it with comparison, WMAP 7 plus SPT, we're actually quite significantly far away from the line 1, which is what we got a lot of emails for about a year, until if you calibrate it to Planck, that prediction, and Boss is like right smack on it. My friends were like, were you guys just, you know, rigging your data? But no, because we actually published it 2012. So that was kind of cool. This is SDSS3. This is 6DF, I think. These are wiggle C points at higher ratio but smaller volume of data, and these are SDSS 1 and 2 data release 7 points. And I think that's pretty interesting to say that, you know, BAO is like a completely independent measure of H0 parameters in such a way that, well, we kind of see this coming even before Planck release. Looking to the future, right? So Planck is going to be the best temperature experiment for a while until maybe we have like the mu distortion type of experiment that people have been talking about. Well, in the meantime, we have like a great host of large scale structure experiments surveying a whole lot of sky. So I'm just going to show you my view of things, but there are experiments I did not include, like DES, which I'm not on. But you can see that that's SDSS3 that will finish 2014. There's SDSS4, that's the next reincarnation of it, that will finish at 2017. There is, of course, multiple polarization experiments that's going on for CMB. But there is also 21 centimeter, that's basically large scale structure. We have Big Boss, or now we named MS-DASY. PFS, this is a prime focus spectrograph that's on super telescopes, like 8-meter telescope. HSC is a hyper-supreme cam telescope that's also on super, and not to mention LSST and Euclid, that are both happening. And different color schemes give you whether it's optical imaging or spectroscopy, CMB or radio. Right, and you can see this all planned all the way to like 2020 something.
Are you on all of these?
A lot of them. Not all of them. I'm not on any of the ACT poll or SPT poll, obviously, or the chat. But this is actually what it happens to be what CMU people are on. So that's the total number. We're not on DES, for example, which we forgot to put on.
When you write down experiments that are CMB experiments, you mean you're doing the surveys using like SCE or how?
Oh, you mean
like say Planck? I don't usually think of it as a large scale structure.
No, I don't mean this is large scale. Surveys of the sky. That's including cosmic background. For me, it's just.
There's structure in the CMB.
That's true.
This I meant surveys of the sky. That's why I included like ACT poll, and then you can see SPT poll is like another one, right? I have to pull in this plot very quickly. And but the cool thing is you can see things happening all the way to like 2020 something for a large scale structure in both imaging and spectroscopy. So what can we do, right? Given that not only standard cosmological parameters we can, you know, get a handle on when we combine it with CMB. And also there's some of neutrino masses and effective small scale power possibly constrained neutrino properties and dark matter properties, right? And large scale power might give you FNL constraints or maybe scale dependence of that. That might give you initial conditions constraints on inflation and maybe other ideas, right? People would look at. I think Roman Skoshmara just told me he's going to talk about three-point correlation function in the in the upcoming Johns Hopkins meetings for SDSS3. So maybe we'll finally see a bispectrum paper coming up from large scale structure. So can we learn from large scale structure? Like, we're going to have all these data points. So what do we do? But let's take a quick look, right? I was just saying how cool a large scale structure is. If you just have large scale structure plus Planck versus not plus large scale structure, you can see the improvement by looking at Planck plus WMAP polarization experiments. Just concentrate on either sum of neutrino masses or the W, right? So if sum of neutrino masses basically went from less than 0.933 to less than 0.247, just because it added BAO, right? That's from Planck paper. And that's for a W, it went from minus 1.5 plus minus 0.65 to minus 1.13 plus minus 0.2. That's like a pretty huge difference just adding BAO. I mean, that's...
Yeah, but Planck has almost no information on... Actually, there's a perfect degeneracy on W. I guess it's CB lensing breaks it, so... That
CB
might
lensing.
As well be infinity.
Hmm?
W, right?
Yeah, well, for W. But that they actually had a prior on some of these things, like because of that prior, you're actually not infinite.
That's their Achilles heel, in other words, is W.
Yeah. But then also some of the neutrino mass and all these other things are doing pretty well.
For sure.
So I would claim that large scale structure really helped a lot just by looking at that to that.
So what's driving the neutrino limit when you add GAO?
What's driving the neutrino? What do you mean exactly? What's the information coming in from?
Yeah,
that was just, I think, the overall shape of the power spectrum. Well, actually, hold on. They did not include that in the BAO constraint, actually. So for this one, I'm speaking out of what I usually do, which I use the full shape, which helps. But then I guess here it's only the BAO constraint, so it does not include the full shape information. It only just takes the distance. So D of E and H, that's it.
So it must be breaking the degeneracy.
Breaking it with H. So omega H square, it breaks the H degeneracy.
Right, Planck's H is...
pretty good with...
Right, but it's in conflict with local H's. And so
it's in conflict with local H, so but it's in agreement, sorry.
So given that Planck's H naught is in somewhat tension with local measurements, and given that neutrinos seem to be somewhat degenerate with H naught, then I guess how seriously should I take this measurement?
Oh, so this is also why you only see Planck paper adding BAO results, right? So none of these constraints put in local H.
Right, yeah, so
not
if you,
then you actually
detection in neutrino masses.
So the funny thing, yes. So we actually recently just put in Planck Cosmo, like running with Cosmo MC Planck plus H naught or not, plus supernova or not, and then plus the VAO result or not. And you can see that there is actual tension that you make the error much bigger if you put a certain set of parameters together. Yeah. And if you want to reconcile the Planck SC cluster result with the no SC cluster result, then you will need to have like neutrino mass or something. I mean, non-zero neutrino masses. Anyway, but that's, I mean, these are all very interesting things that I think you're going to talk about neutrino masses, I heard.
Isn't it one of those things that you either pick one of the anomalies, either H0 or massive neutrinos or N effective greater than 3? Is that about right, that one of those anomalies is
so
trade off one for another?
So the SC, so there's a Planck SC paper that the sigma 8 was very different from this paper, for example. And you can reconcile by one of these things. I don't remember which ones of those, but like neutrino mass was one of them.
We can trade off there.
Okay. So the next thing is a quick intro to large field structure, in particular to BAO, just very quickly, because I know people probably know about it here. But basically, this is the Baron-Kurzweil oscillations are just the perturbation at the very beginning, and you have this wave that pushes out, which was driven by the radiation pressure. And it drives out, and it drags along the electrons because it's inverse quantum scattering with the electrons, and the electrons drags along the protons and everything else. And at some point, the universe is cold enough that the radiation basically just leaves, and leaving this ring of matter behind. And that's where that came from. It's very tricky, very simple. And of course, we have multiple perturbations, so that's why when we do correlation function, we're doing all the different galaxies. Okay, but basically, it's just take what you learn from CMB, and you move it forward, and that's the matter power spectrum. With these wiggles, that's the Baron-Kurzweil oscillation. This is exactly the same thing as before. Okay, this is just for, I thought there might be people who are more junior here, but this is probably too easy for you guys. I would calculate the correlation function in configuration space, and usually what we do is that I'll look at the typical American family for fun, and I'll ask yourself, what is the typical daytime correlation function of American population? So that kind of gets you thinking, what is a correlation function? And what I usually do is that mom and dad goes to work, and on average, Americans commute 20 minutes, I think 22 minutes to work. So that turns into about 20 miles or so, depending how fast you drive. Kids then pass day at home or nearby school with a Gaussian distribution. So if you do that, then you can calculate correlation function during daytime, and it's going to have a bump at about 20 miles. So same thing's happening with galaxies, except this time it's radiation pressure driving this. So instead of they're commuting 20 miles, just imagine a car broke down, you know, after 150 megaparsec or so. Sorry, this is a fun part, how to do correlation function. And we have a correlation function bump at about 150 megaparsec or 100 megaparsec over H, more or less. So the following is a plot that I like to show people how large structure people think. Usual thought process, and I'll call it the cosmology analysis engine, but it's very similar even for CMB, and I'm just going to concentrate on BAO in this case. We have the observations on top, and we have some basic reduction pipeline that we don't understand, and we have extracted objects, observation systematics, all these properties, and then we try to remove some larger structure systematics, and we estimate measurements here. So it could be full-scale clustering, could be Baron-Kurzweil oscillations, whatever you want. And then you have theory that could be linear or nonlinear, depending how well we understand our theory. And we have some simulations that either used to be testing the pipeline or measuring something called a covariance matrix, which you guys all know, and we get cosmology at the end. Could be anything, right? You can imagine this plot. But what I'm going to talk about today in particular is how do you do parse of these better. That's the cosmology analysis engine I'm going to talk about. How do you, for example, measure covariance matrix quickly so we don't have to run the simulation for 10,000 hours? Or how do we make the measurements better? Can we get more information out of it? Or if you want to ask me, I can talk about theory later on too, which is how to make better predictions beyond linear models. And that's stuff that are very active because we don't know very much about those. And here we go. So let me just pause here and ask if there are questions, complaints, people falling asleep. I'll throw chalk at them. Nope. No questions? Because there are a lot of acronyms I'm throwing in, assuming you guys know here. So just raise your hand. Because I've been learning acronym definition all week long. Here. Nope. Okay. You guys are smarter than me. All right. Let's go. What is this populating halos with galaxies using machine learning? So I'm going to talk about making simulations of the universe, but then instead of just simulating using computer, I'm still using computer, but using machine learning that basically takes an original observation that we have very nice simulations, and then learn this property mapping, and applied it to a very coarse grain simulation, but then try to get the same output at the end. You know, skipping the step of very hard simulation, basically. And I'm using something called the machine learning that a lot of people probably know about it here, but I'm just going to go through it quickly. So why populate these halos, right? So people need to make mock galaxy catalogs, not only to test the codes, but also to create these covariance matrix, which people usually just run over 10,000 simulations and see how do you actually create correlation function from each of them, and then you calculate the covariance across all of them, and it gives you the error bar of the measurements. And usually people will say, okay, we can do maybe n-body simulation plus hydro. That's very expensive, especially plus the hydro part. Or do perturbation theory and try to, say, more or less model what's happening and then do some prescription on it. So we're just trying to do something slightly different here, and I'll explain why. The popular halo occupation population schemes in fast forward mode, that's just to introduce some acronyms for you guys. One is the halo occupation distribution. They assume some kind of model mapping, often the mass, to the number of galaxies per halo. Could be anything. And then the next thing is called subhalo abundance matching, which finds all the subhalos in the simulations, and then you assume each contains the galaxies, and you go down in mass. Both have been shown to work very well, very intuitive, right? And you can see all these references that people had worked on it a lot. But then there are no complaints here, but I asked myself, can I do a little better than what we had done before? So what we did is that we decided to talk to our machine learning friends in CMU and say, hey, can we learn the trends from the data directly? And it does not pre-impose any models at all.
I think so, there's actually lots of complaints about, you said no complaints.
Well, no complaints from me.
Empirical methods that have no fundamental reason to work, right? They have to be calibrated.
So why do you say that they have no fundamental reason? I mean, you know, halos are the sites where all these sources of light and occur, right? So why is it crazy to populate halos with these sources of light that we...
No, it's not. And of course, it's one of the only things that there you can do about it. But then you have some free parameters you need to match the simulations.
Okay. But those parameters are trying to describe physics, which we just do not know how to calculate. Right?
Yeah.
So that's exactly why we wanted to use machine learning, because there are things we just don't know.
So maybe complain to that level.
Okay. So, yeah, okay, sure. The complaint is that we don't know how to calculate strong formation in primary.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't.
So that's why we're trying to use something like machine learning to try to see, can we do it without knowing these things? We'll see. Actually, I will show you. We actually, because of a very nice referee report, we actually check whether we're better than HOD, which is kind of nice. I'll show you soon. We just want to introduce what's machine learning just quickly for everyone here, because not everyone works on it, right? So how do we utilize this machine learning algorithm? We first identify a training set. It has to be a representative sample to some extent. It could be a hydro simulation that you give me that's been run for a million CPU hours. Or it could be better observations directly that are very good representative sample. In our case, we actually have neither of them. So we use the Millennium simulation just because we don't have a better sample, but it could be anything. That's a good representative sample. And then we learn the mapping between the features, which in this case could be halo mass, could be spin of the halo, velocities, halos, whatever. And the value you're interested in. In our case, it was galaxies of certain type. It could be blue or red galaxies, higher mass, lower mass galaxies, whatever you want to predict from the training set. So you learn the mapping between the features, like halo mass or something, or spin of halo, or half mass radius of halo, to the number of galaxies, and you apply the mapping. Machine learning algorithms are not magical or anything like that. It's just fancy interpolation scheme, basically. And it has been shown to work on many cool things, and I'm going to show you some cool things they've done. This is a question. Oh, if we can dim the light, because you can't see them very well. Let me try if it works here. Trial and error won't work. Anyway, so on the left-hand side, it only turns on the lights, apparently. On the left-hand side, we're actually querying an image that looks like that, which is trying to say, look at a million images online and just to find a match to this picture. And it turns out that it can match all the different seasons of the same image. They're very different color, they're very different lighting, and it turned out to match. That's one example of machine learning. The other example is a funny question that was posed as a joke at the beginning of the semester, and it says, can you find the most distinctive feature of Paris? And they were going to bet it's Eiffel Tower or the Louvre, right? But it turned out to be wrong, actually. So we run machine learning algorithm. The most interesting thing was actually the railings and like right outside the windows, which you can't see very well, unfortunately, in this image right here. And also the street lamps was another thing. And the street signs were specific to Paris, but not the other cities in the world, supposedly. Not Louvre, not Eiffel Tower. So someone won the bet, obviously. And it's all using machine learning. Google Street View also went indoors, right? So now they have to match images that went from, you know, this image is actually matched to all these other ones. Because we're actually going to have to say this is the same place as all the other images people have taken. So machine learning has been applied to many everyday stuff. But we're going to do it with halos and galaxies mapping, which are very different application. We're using the simplest machine learning algorithm here. There are harder things that we're trying right now for different reasons. But this is called a support vector machine that basically maps data to higher dimensional space with a kernel. And what it's basically doing is to do that. So imagine it's just 2D, and you have a bunch of solid points and empty circles. If you separate them, you actually just basically straighten this out instead. So it's very simple mechanism. The other thing is even simpler. It's called KNN. It's K-nearest neighbor. So a picture will be easiest. If you have some A and B type stuff here, and I put a point here, then you're actually going to look at like a radius outside myself and say whether I'm an A or B. And in this case, likely to be B. But there are many, many tricky things that you can do with that particular algorithm, obviously. So we're using the simplest machine learning algorithm. And the reason is it turned out to work well, and we don't have to switch to harder ones. And I'll show you how. So how do we know it works well? We actually look at something called a mean square error, which is looking at the difference between the true and the predicted. So we have a test set. You want to compare your prediction to the test set's true value. And you're looking at the square of it, divide it out all of it. So just looking at a mean square error itself. It's very easy. And we want to see whether we're doing better than a simplest, stupidest thing that's called basically replacing by the average of the subset, right? So if I don't know anything, I just take the average of the data and I apply only to the test set. And that's called a base MSE when you just replace the predicted value by the mean. And why in our case right now is any value, but it should be number of galaxies in certain type of galaxies. Yeah, but it could be anything you want in some sense. It's what you want to predict.
And the training
training sample is a galaxy catalog from this, from simulation?
Yeah. So the training sample is Millennium, but we can train on anything. We actually started with data first, but we didn't have a large enough data set. I mean, we don't have a million Google images, basically, right? So we end up using Millennium because it supplies us 800,000 halos, something like that.
The number of free parameters and comparison thing that you're doing the same as for your machine learning prediction?
Comparison in which one? Sorry.
So you have this other way of doing it, right? The other thing
you're comparing to. You mean HOD, or do you mean other? So the KNN and
the SVM. Second bullet point when you were doing this averaging.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm comparing to that one, too. So the Bayes MSE.
Right, yeah.
This is this one.
So is the number of free parameters in that averaging thing the same as in
your? So the parameters are, there are two kernel parameters you have to fit for. And we basically do a grid and choose which one gives you the best results. And that's what we do also for Bayes MSE.
And it's the same number of parameters.
Yeah. OK. So what do we do? We want to use machine learning to learn about how many galaxies or specific kinds of galaxies are in halos with certain properties. We can do this with real data, but since we don't have that much, we decide to use simulations that include all or some physics, and in this case, Millennium. Yes, questions?
Maybe you already said, but could you say quickly what Millennium is?
Oh, yes. Actually, I don't know very much about Millennium. It is, from my perspective, it is a catalog of galaxies that has the corresponding halos where it is in. And I think what they did is that they basically had some semi-analytical models that maps from the halos properties to the galaxies. It's like they would say when it turns on star formation and when it doesn't and stuff like that. But I don't know any of these relations. I just took it as like it's an observation.
But it's a simulation based on some data from our universe, or just completely a simulation?
It's a simulation that uses initial conditions, like it's a grid on, I think, WMAP 5. And then it just runs forward with some dark matter properties, I mean, with mostly dark matter. And then it has some semi-analytical models that said, oh, you know, if it reaches certain things, it turns on star formation or not. So I have no idea what these mapping are. And I just use it as a training set, basically, and a test set, too. So the goal is that we can take high or good resolution simulation and or data and learn how to populate halos with galaxies given the dark matter halo properties. And then we can, in turn, take the dark matter halos from a large number of not expensive simulations. Like dark matter simulations takes hours to run, right? And it's easy. And make many independent mock catalogs. So that's the Millennium parameters here. That's actually just the cosmological parameters that they used. Sigma 8 is quite off. Actually, so is Omega Matter. And we're only using the central and satellite galaxies of primary Millennium halos with mass cuts. And there are like many of them. And we're only using subsample to 60,000 of them for test. So we split the data into three sets, very easy. We train with 1/3 of it. We validate the grid size that I was telling Neil earlier. You actually have to grid it and validate for it, and that's this part. And one for testing, we predict the number of galaxies given what we learned from the training set. Actually, can someone turn on the lights again? Thank you. And there's some results already. You can actually see that if you plot the true number of galaxies in each halo and plot the true number of galaxies predicted on each for each halo, they're actually doing pretty well. The Bayes MSE is what you have if you have assumed that the average is what you should predict. And the smaller the mean square error, of course, the better. That's for SVM. For KNN, it doesn't do as well. But if you include the whole data set, KNN did pretty well. And if you do an HOD fit, say if I have an observation, I do a halo occupation distribution fit to it, and then use that to predict just the same thing we have done here. You can find an MSE about 0.199, still actually didn't do as well as SVM or the KNN with the full data set. So it can prove that we're actually learning something more than the simple halo occupation distribution that people have been doing recently.
what does this machine learn? What is it learning that Halo looks in simulation, and then what does it learn? Halo of some true mass has this number of galaxies? Is that the learning process?
So it's not doing just mass. It's doing, actually it has 9 parameters that we took from the Halo catalogs. It has spin of the Halo, for example. It has the density environment of the Halo that we could, in principle, people would talk about maybe affecting galaxy formation. It also took into account of, you know, how concentrated the Halo is. All these parameters were in there.
And they're not observable, like color.
Well, we don't have colors of, well, we do have colors of the galaxy, but there are no colors of halos, right? So just colors of the halos, we are colors of the galaxies, we are using them, but that's a prediction. That's not a feature we're using.
Okay, so you don't want to train on observable properties. You're training on, like, say, spin, but we don't measure it.
Right. But in principle, we can measure mass, you can measure concentration, you can measure density environment of halos. And it turned out that, so we did a test to test which property is most important to predict number of galaxies, and it turned out to be the R and half, which basically the half mass radius, which is not the mass of halo, but it's related. But it's also related to the concentration of the halo. And it turned out to be like this. But this is from Millennium, right?
The best predictor of
The number of galaxies in halo, and that's for all galaxies, blue or red galaxies, same thing. So that's something we can learn, basically.
So,
yes, question.
Is one of the primary properties of the halo you choose anything to the history of the halo?
We didn't have that information, but we could. I mean, we have density environment, but that's not exactly the history. I mean, we don't have basically when is it formed. You know, there's a halo formation, a variable we could in principle put, but we didn't have that but we could.
Since last merger
or something. We didn't trace the halo. We didn't trace the merger tree, basically, but we could in principle do that. That's actually showing you the distribution, number of galaxies in each halo, and basically showing the test true, which is the black line, and the test predicted, which is the red line. And you can see the red and the black are pretty okay. Maybe not so much at the very very large number of galaxies ones. And of course, we need to do the correlation function because that's what we use for covariance matrices. And you can see that the test true, which is the triangle here, and test predictive basically quite nicely on top of each other, even when the training set was a bit off. And you can do it for blue and red galaxies all you want, different stellar mass galaxies.
Yes, you're matching the results of some semi-analytic model. And so that model puts in galaxies into the halos based on properties of those halos. And you're training this thing using properties of halos, right?
Right, but I have no idea what those properties they trained on and how they did it.
No, sure, right. You know,
but this method,
isn't it?
I see what you're asking, but this method can be used on data sets. It can be used on other, like, hydro data sets, if you can give me a good one, but we don't have one. So that's why I think the circularity doesn't exist if, in an ideal world, I get an actual observation that's large enough, which may or may not happen soon, but...
But you never train on observations, right? You know, since we can never actually measure the intrinsic properties of data as an actual...
I think that's sort of Dragon's point, but I think you can still measure a bunch of different properties, right? Like concentration, you can measure it. You can measure mass.
Not individual objects, right?
But you can probably do it.
On simulations, right? In which case, then your results are only as good as your simulations subgrid.
Right.
Galaxy formation, blah, blah, blah.
So if you can only train on simulations and even for the best simulations, you don't believe them, then yes, I think that's true. But this is cool when you can apply it to data, and I'm hoping some of this, parts of it can be applied to data with larger numbers. I mean, individual halo properties are tough. I agree, but we have some of them. We should talk about
it. What people do to test how well their photometric redshift estimators work is they take these simulations with galaxies painted on, so you need that, and then they know the true redshift, presumably, and then they have colors So they try different methods using those colors and see which one works better.
Mm-hmm.
So it just seems that you maybe would have wanted to do the same thing on observable properties, right? I guess you
yeah.
don't want the simulation with galaxies painted on it, but then...
Well, which is what we kind of have. I mean, Millennium is sort of, they will claim that they match really well with observables.
I guess I really meant colors, because colors is what we most
use. So we use the colors as one of the predictive properties. We're not using it as features. So it's not inputs, outputs. Okay, mini conclusion. Machine learning offers a completely model-independent method for understanding, you know, halo galaxy mapping while avoiding subhalo finding. And it predicts, it gives robust predictions for the number of galaxies per halo, and the distribution of halos with number of galaxies, and the galaxy correlation function. And there are many other possible applications of machine learning that I would love to brainstorm with people here. One of the things we've been doing is to basically try to figure out how to connect initial conditions of the universe, well, not too initial, but basically say redshift 49, to us. Like, can we make that prediction even? Like, just skip the whole simulation step, for example, just to throw it out for fun. Okay, I have another cool thing to show you guys, but I'll hopefully go quickly on this one. That's how to measure large hadron structure signal, right? Can we get more information out of it? Like, we know how to measure these things, but can we do it better? Can we get more information? And one recent technique is to look at something called a reconstruction that I was hoping Matthias was here, but he wrote a paper with Tassa Saliaga, right, that talks about how to do reconstruction even better. And we'll be talking a little bit about it right now, which basically reconstruction is going from the nonlinear universe backwards in time. That's basically all it is. You try to go back a little bit, and the reason is you can improve the BAO signal a little bit better. But there's a lot of reason why you want to go back to a more linear universe. So why reconstruction? Dan and Eisenstein et al. 2006 have shown us this, actually. That's the correlation function in redshift space. And I don't know if you guys can see the different colors, but that's the blue is what we actually observe in the nonlinear redshift space. You can see how not pronounced the peak is. And the linear is so much more pronounced because nonlinear evolution has basically smoothed out the peak along the way. And what we're trying to do is to go back from what we have to that as much as we can. And that's the whole premise of reconstruction, how to go back in time just a tiny bit so that you can do the BAO better, but you can, of course, do all the statistics a little bit better.
It's the idea that you
yes.
observe the blue line in large
mm-hmm.
structure, and,
mm-hmm.
and then you go back to the CMB?
Well, not to the CMB yet, but like maybe to redshift 5 or 10 or so. So we are at redshift like 0.5.
I'm confused about the fact that at the CMB we also have observations.
Mm-hmm.
So we have observations in these two windows that you want to match.
Well, it's kind of true what you just said, actually. But we're not even thinking that far into CMB. We're not trying to match the CMB to our current observation. We're mostly trying to say, can we go back, you know, say a giga year back? And that will bring such a flat peak, which we're trying to detect this peak, and that's what we get this, you know, H0 confirmation with Planck, to a much sharper peak. And that will give you a much better signal to noise. So that's the basic reason. And of course, you can say, well, if we can go back slightly further back in time, what else can you learn about the universe earlier in time? That's another question that we're not addressing today. That's what Dana Eisenstein and her students back then, Heejong So, has shown us. If you correlate the linear universe, which is at redshift 49, and what they reconstructed or not reconstructed density field, defined and then normalize it, and you can see that with reconstruction, which is a blue line, will get you a lot more information than the black line when you don't reconstruct. So that's what we were trying to say. And this is in K range with the Fourier space. And yes, I think that's in redshift space. You actually see also the same increase in information going to the blue line instead of the black line. That's the premise. Trying to glean more information by going back a little bit further. And you can maybe imagine fitting linear theory a little bit better, because it's not so nonlinear anymore. Questions? I'll pause here. It's actually theoretically how to go back in time. So I'll show you how people do that. So Tarnatabha in 2012 showed this in a slightly different way. Unfortunately, you can't see the color scale that well, but if you don't reconstruct and you don't have pressure space distortion, which causes squashing that people might have seen before with the finger of God effect in the center and large squashing on the outside like this, and if you reconstruct it, which you cannot see, I'm sorry about the color scale, you will see the BAO peak to be a lot better, which you can't see at all. Sorry about that. But then, same thing with the pressure space distortions. Once you reconstruct it, you can actually see that it's more spherical, like back to more spherical terms. Exactly what happened in Sloan Data Release 7 is that you go from this plot to this plot, which you can see slightly better. It's sharpening the BAO peak by removing basically nonlinear effects of the evolution of the universe. And it basically goes from 3.5% to 1.9%, and you increase the volume of the survey by about a factor of 3 for free, right? So how do we do this theory, right? And I will skip this part, but the general idea is that I actually don't have to explain the equations here, maybe even in this crowd. Basically, we calculate the displacement field according to the density field of all the galaxy positions. So if you have a bunch of galaxy here, you know the things are falling into the potential well, right? So we try to backtrack on this. So that's very, very simple, very linear theory. And you just basically remove that displacement by going, that's called going back in time, that's all. It's very simple. You move, but then in real situation, you have to fill empty space in the survey because the survey is not complete of the whole sky. And what you do is that you first, there's a density field in the back, which is represented by the color. Then you calculate the potential for all the whole survey. And then you find out the displacement, and you move them backwards for all the single particles. So that's the basic idea. People are trying very hard, and Matthias and his students, well, his student used to be a student, Tassef was trying to do this even better, to apply a filter that basically gets a better correlation between the low redshift displacement field and the initial field. Or maybe you can iterate it to maximize this particular displacement to find out, okay, this is the best we can do. So they also had a paper that talked about this. So actually that's a really, that basically just look at early universe initial conditions and then what we have right now and then do a correlation between the two.
Sure, fine. Yeah. That was your previous version, I guess, right?
No, that's actually this line.
Okay, yeah. But in practice though,
we do filter also in practice, even without this.
What does that mean, though?
So what does that mean exactly?
So you throw away all the high K displacements? Is that basically?
Exactly. You throw away high K power, basically. So you remember this plot? Basically, you do that. And you want to also include the fact that there's, you know, more galaxy here and less galaxies there. So that's another, the Wiener filtering was also on top of this.
Cool. To go from the galaxy density field to the displacement,
mm-hmm.
there is an unknown bias there.
Yes. People just assume the bias so far. We can do better, but we haven't done better. So what Tarnatabha 2012 has done, or what BOSS is doing right now, which is the result that Planck is using, has just assumed a bias. But it we checked that assuming a bias doesn't really cause any trouble at all. So you can be, it doesn't cause any trouble if your bias is within 20-30% of the true value. So from simulations, we check this.
The entropy of that displacement is directly proportional.
Very correct, yeah. We still have a lot of issues, which I'm going to show you guys. So the reason I got interested in this is because for data release 9, the BAO peak after reconstruction didn't do anything. So we asked ourselves, what happened? And can we do better? And that's why we started working on this. Okay, what else? So there are other recycled ideas that, or new ideas that we've been looking at, different filtering scheme. Neil has pointed out one of the main things we've been looking at particular different filters. Whether we should iterate it, think of GOT compression, stuff that we should do to make it a little better for estimating a density field. There are at least actually a method back in the days that I just started reading about that we haven't really looked at. And how to fill in the empty space happens to matter too. And all this kind of comes up to be, there are three different groups working on this right now. One is from Portsmouth. And you can see that this is a plot from all the density fields and how to look at particular displacement field. In Nikhil Pamanabhan and his group's displacement factor is actually quite different from the Portsmouth group, even though they claim to have the same algorithm, theoretically speaking. So the question is, where did that came from? And I'll show you a little bit same slide, I mean, same zoom-in region, but with different methods. That's Nikhil's method from 2012. That's actually the one we used in Bos collaboration. A high-density region here, and you can see all the displacement factor pointing this way. Looks good. Portsmouth's group's method is also slightly different, especially this region's. You can see the factor starting to turn, and our group also have slightly different from everyone else.
Is the overdensity as well as vectors reconstructed or just the vectors?
Just the factors are reconstructed. I mean, the factors are displacement lengths. I mean, the length is how much the displacement should be, and these are just points of the galaxy themselves.
Well, the color scheme is, the color
it's
island
the density
looks
field,
the same.
Not reconstructed. Yeah. So the question is, how do we check which one is correct? Or can we do better, either one? We applied our method to data release 10, which will be public in July 2013. And even for different methods, we actually get the correlation function to be very similar. The red solid line and the black solid line are two different groups, two different methods after reconstruction. And you can see the peak got bigger, which is kind of good. Non-reconstructed is the dashed line. You can see all the differences I showed you didn't show up or didn't matter in the correlation function. And we ask ourselves, does that make sense? Yes?
What's linear on this plot? This is the linear theory given.
Linear theory. Yes. Exactly. So that's this linear theory plot. And we're not expecting this to fit for the retrospective distortions, this part, obviously. We didn't apply Kaiser here because, in principle, we should go from the dashed line to the linear theory line, right? That's the goal. But it's not there yet. Although the BAO peak did look better. I mean, they get sharper. But is that the only thing we care about? Yes.
So I guess one question would have been worrying about overfitting. But the match to linear theory here is not a coincidence. The fact that the peak is in the same place is not a coincidence. Is that you put the linear theory peak where it was supposed to be given the best fit for this reconstructed data?
Yes, exactly. So that is fitted to the reconstructed data, not fitting first of all to the non-reconstructed data and then plot the linear theory.
So a simulation where you knew the linear initial spectrum, then the agreement would be.
I have a plot on this, but I don't have it on the talk. But it's not, the linear theory in the simulation is still not what we got at the end after reconstruction. So there's still work to do, basically.
Are they lined up and it's broader, or is it like offset at all?
They are lined up, which is good, but this part is still not completely clear out. Okay. But there's also effects of different reconstruction method choices that, just to remind you guys, alpha is this basically position of the BAO peak, modulo what it's supposed to be. So if it's larger than 1, then it's to a smaller scale. Smaller than 1 shifts to larger scale. So always opposite what you think it should be. And if you do different filling of the empty space with different things, and if you iterate differently, I mean, number of times, 1 iteration, 2 iterations, 3 iterations, you actually see different answers. And then now that we said, oh, BAO is awesome because it's the same as the Planck result, but then all these other things were going on under the hood, and we're trying to figure out, is there a correct way to do it? Or maybe we should figure out what is the right metric even to decide which reconstruction to use. Anyway, at least...
The DR11, I guess, you know, that hole won't be there anymore, right?
We actually have results on DR11.
Yeah,
so I can show you.
Whatever, does it really matter?
Like, well, you still have to fill the stuff outside, like the boundaries, right? I mean, it's not a cube that's handed to you, unfortunately. Yeah, it shouldn't matter as much as Neil was saying, DR11, which will basically fill up the whole density very nicely. But it might not, we don't know. And we have to try different filters, for example. Anyway, it got better, at least, when you have multiple reconstruction iterations. When you have 1, 2, 3 iterations, you can see the error bar going down on the fit of the BAO peak position. But that might not be the only metric we want to use. But still, it brings, basically reconstruction brings from 1.6% to 1.1% measurement on the BAO, and it's basically increasing the survey volume by a factor of 2 for free, which is kind of cool. Okay, I promised you guys about anomalies in large structure just for fun, just to stir some theoretical discussions. That's what we didn't show you in the Boss paper. We cut at this. So this is the power spectrum of the galaxy. We cut it exactly at this, actually at -2. You can check the archive paper just to not show this point, because we think it's probably systematics, but we don't know. The BAO peak is beautiful. I mean, peaks were beautiful. This is the power spectrum. I mean, it's probably a little stronger than you expected when you look at this, even this part. And next thing, for fun. If you split the data in north and south, and that's going back to correlation space, the north has these, this is the BAO peak, linear theory with omega matter of 0.261, which is slightly wrong, is here. And the south was kind of going crazy.
Does this show excess of power at large scales like the previous? Does it show the same excess of power? So is it that the real thing should have been lower on the right?
On the right, well, I'll show you the next plot very quickly. This is actually easier to see. This is 100 megaparsec over H, right? So that's where the BAO peak is. The north is the red, the south is the blue. And so in real life, you should, well, in theoretically beautifully, you know, linear theory or whatever, you should see this peak and then it should be all the same. The red and the blue and the black to some, you know, error bar. And that's about 200 megaparsec, and there's some extra power in large scales.
South is much smaller, right? It's much smaller.
Much smaller, but it's getting bigger now, so.
But it's very noisy.
But it might just be systematics, which is what I'm showing you here. So if you use some kind of, maybe the star is doing something. So we make some adjustments to our density field by weighting the density field with stellar weight. I will not explain what that is exactly, but it'll ask me. So if we don't weight the stellar weight, that's the red line. If you weight with the stars, it kind of drops. You know, the power is not as bad. I mean, this is what you expect, right? But there's still all this extra power out there. So probably systematics, but even with the best ideas we had, we have not cleared out everything.
The stellar weight is with the weight, the regions with a lot of stars.
So basically what happened is the stars, whenever there's more stars, we have some funny correlations between the galaxies and the stars. It's probably coming from the photometry. When there's a bright star, you affect how well you can see the galaxy behind it or around it. That's the first guess. Anyway, so I'll leave you guys with this plot again, just to see, you know, the measurements has a lot of funny issues that we don't know, and you can actually make it better by using theoretical tools, going back in time to make better measurements. We hopefully will get simulations even faster than before without just waiting for the computer scientists. And actually, I have plots to show that. And maybe there we can make better theory predictions. We've been working on trying to predict the retrospace distorted correlation function better with bias. And it actually starting to work quite well, which I can talk about if people want to ask me later. The covariance matrices, and Planck will have twice more temperature data and also polarization data next year, so we'll have to build a better BAO analysis we can keep decreasing not only a statistical but also systematic error from both theory and the data side. And I'll leave you guys with that upward note. Thanks. Questions?
I have a question about reconstruction, which, I mean, naively, on large scales, it sounds like you observe galaxy positions and then you displace them using the original galaxy positions.
Correct.
And since it's large scale, everything is linear.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, at the end of the day, it's just a linear operation on the data. Given an initial density field, I apply an operator on that density field. It might be non local and everything because it will stop the source equation, but it still is a linear operator.
Okay.
And if it's a linear operator, it's a little hard to see why it should gain anything, because I can either apply that operator to the observed data and
right.
get the linear theory, or I can apply the same operator in reverse to the theory and get the data.
Yeah, that's
and
a very good question.
It seems I shouldn't gain any extra information. The only way you could is somehow your operation is not completely linear.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what's going on, that there are places where the displacement field is large enough that, in fact, it's actually not quite a linear operation?
I actually don't have an answer here. I haven't looked into this myself. But you're basically asking a question if we're doing field transformation on a field that's Gaussian on large scale, and it's a linear operation. Why aren't we getting more information?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I don't have an answer to that, but we should talk about this a little bit more.
It doesn't even have to be Gaussian, but basically what you're doing is some kind of linear operation. It doesn't seem like I can do it backward or forward, but either way, I should be preserving basically the same.
How would you do it forward? This is a theoretical quantity. I mean, here you have a field of realizations, right? So depending on your realization, you'll do a different thing.
Yes.
But if you do it on theory, that's a power spectrum. It's a statistical quantity. So it seems to be a different beast, right?
Well, she takes the data, apply a linear transformation, and then measure the power spectrum. At the end, that's what she does. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So
Daniel has a...
Is it just the estimator you apply to the... I mean, because they're just looking for a peak. They're not taking some good model for... Like, you're just looking for what the scale of the peak is and putting an error
yeah.
on that. Which is not the optimal estimator, which is the one presumably you would define with this nonlinear transformation. And that would... So in principle, it may not be more data, just that it's a technique that reduces the error bar, given the amount of data available.
Yeah, you're saying she's focusing on a very narrow question, which is just
looking at the
position
of
the
peak. The
peak.
And you're just saying use all the data.
If
you
use all the data,
it.
Then you should not be getting anything.
Well, I mean, that might be the point, because when you use Russia space distortions included, like if you can predict Russia space distorted, biased, included correlation function or power spectrum, then you have all the information in there. Then you can, in principle, get back all the information. But then when you don't do that, because we don't know the nonlinear theory for Russia space distorted biased correlation function, then it's hard.
Maybe another way to say is you somehow are trying to measure the BO scale better by doing this reconstruction, and somehow you're not quite using the information that are containing the higher correlation functions. You're just measuring the power spectrum at the end of the day with a linear transformation on the data. And presumably you could do better by actually using the information in the higher order correlation functions.
Yeah, I think the Russia space distortions is the part that I realized when Daniel just said it, is that when you include modeling Russia space distortions and fitting for both the monopole and the quadrupole, then you actually gain most of the information back. But that's not all of the information, I think, still, because we don't have a perfect theory for that Russia space distorted bias theory. Neil, you have something you were saying?
Oh, no,
sorry, I just thought you were
okay, sure.
yes, let's ask questions.
yeah. So making improvements in the future for doing reconstruction, what would you want? So, would you want to have a higher density of galaxies to better sample the matter field?
What do I want? I mean, right now we actually... in general. Right now, we're actually trying to fit not only for this peak position, but also something called the epsilon, which basically measures how the dipole, actually the quadrupole, actually looks like. And that would also help you realizing whether you are back to linear theory. So I would like to have a better metric, actually, the first thing, to measure what is the good reconstruction method. And before we have that, we don't really know what we should have. I mean, higher number density of galaxies will help, but I don't think we're that constrained by the shot noise right now. Yes?
Can we expect a bispectrum?
Roman Scacciamaro just signed up to give a talk in June, actually 2 weeks from now, at Johns Hopkins for the SDSS3 meeting. So I'm looking forward to see it. So what happened is someone announced a project about doing bispectrum on Bosch galaxies one day, and the next day we saw Roman's announcing same project with different method.
He talked about this when I was in graduate school 15 years ago.
That's what I thought too.
So, with a grain of salt.
I know, I'm just being hopeful.
There's no paper from him on the bispectrum? There was like a paper from the actual bispectrum from Sloan. No? Was that my dream?
It's probably your dream. we did ask Roman when is he going to be done with it, and he hasn't. Yeah. But that's going to be very interesting, right? Bispectrum. All right. Thank you.